Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. My guest today is Kate O'Neill, author, speaker, and founder of KO Insights, an organization that's focused on the intersection of human experience, responsible technology, and business strategy. Kate also has the greatest business title I've seen in months, Tech Humanist. That title and Kate's diverse background really piqued my interest, and I was glad for the opportunity to discuss a wide range of topics. Not surprisingly, we covered AI, digital transformation, and return to office. I particularly enjoyed how to be strategically optimistic, as well as how technology should never be seen as a replacement for humans, but used to augment their natural abilities. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Kate. Welcome to Let Go and Lead.
Hi, Meryl. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited. And, you know, I just love the fact that you're widely known as a tech humanist. I think that's just such an incredible combination of words. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I like that term because out of my entire career, I always found that I have this background in languages and I was always a translator in my mind. And so this is, in a sense, translating between the interest we have in technology and what it can do for us, and the interest we have, obviously, as humans in making sure that the humanity and the human experience of our future is preserved. So most of that we know is accelerated. All the technology that meets us is accelerated by business. So it is kind of this three-part equation of making sure business objectives align with human outcomes, and that what we really work on is aligning those as we accelerate and amplify through technology.
One of the things, you know, is Gagan McDonald focuses on the human struggle of change. And I'd just be curious to know, what do you think is the most significant human change we're going through right now?
There seems like there's a lot. I ask this question a lot, and I hear from my clients a lot about how they feel about the future. And it's, I think people feel just overwhelmed. And that might not be an entirely new experience. But I think one of the reasons we feel overwhelmed is that even though we have been through, as humans in our history, we have been through massive, even existential sort of changes before, we didn't do so in an environment where we were in a nonstop onslaught of algorithmically optimized news and social media posts at us constantly, just constantly reinforcing those things to which we most react. That's a different experience. And I think that is gotta be at the core of not only a lot of the overwhelm that people feel, but a lot of the division that people feel as well, you know, kind of amplifying the divisions that we have naturally in culture and in discourse. So I think that's the biggest human issue right now, is just how do we exist in a world that is increasingly driven by tech and optimized by data, and yet still be human, still be, you know, our sort of delicate human selves that have, you know, these very highly tuned, sensitive reactions and sort of feelers in the world. And how do we maintain that balance?
I know you're very optimistic, and you actually wrote a book to that point. Talk to us about your book.
Yeah, so you're referring to my last book was called A Future So Bright, and it is optimistic, but with the caveat. I think the key is, the term I use is strategic optimism. I am optimistic if we are able to use rationality and sensibility to approach some of these issues, and we keep our wits about us, right? If we have a disciplined approach to what we believe the future holds, and we really sort of mitigate the risks we know are there while leaning into the best possible futures, then I think we could do right by ourselves in the future and future generations. But it's by no means a guarantee. And so, you know, the optimism sort of waxes and wanes with the approaches that I see people taking and leaders taking to the future. But it is really important, I think, that we recognize that we do not live in dystopia or utopia. It's not one or the other. It is a constantly shifting set of both and every future scenario hinges on the decisions we make today. So that's a lesson that I constantly try to remind people in keynote audiences and in client advisory sessions and through this book is that you are in control of a lot more than you believe yourself to be. The future is really only a continuation of the past and the present moment. And the present moment, you can still make decisions to shape the future that we're going to be living in. So that is, I think, an incredibly important message for all of us all the time.
And you talk a lot about the human superpowers of like meaning and integrative thinking. How do they play into this?
Yeah, meaning is, I feel, one of the key human conditions and human experiences. Like when you think about what it is that makes us uniquely human, you know, not like other animals and not like machines, one of the few characteristics that really comes, you know, clearly to mind in that context is our tendency toward meaning, our meaning making, meaning seeking that we do. And that, I think, really relates back to, you know, I've mentioned purpose an awful lot during this discussion. And that's why, because purpose is the shape that meaning takes in business. When we think about what it is to understand meaning, meaning is at every level we think about it, whether we're talking about semantic meaning, how we communicate through language, or through some more kind of abstract sense of meaning like purpose or patterns or truth or relevance, significance, or all the way out to the biggest picture and most macro understanding of meaning, which is like cosmic or existential meaning, like what's it all about or why are we here? All of those levels still are all about what matters. We're always talking about what matters. And so when you think about that as it relates to purpose, when you think about that as it relates to how we plan for the future, it is this sense that we kind of got to cut away a lot of the noise and really focus on what it is that matters. What matters that we do? What matters about this decision that's right in front of us? And then another lens that's incredibly important is to say, well, you know, as we think about how we prepare for this tech-driven and data-accelerated, algorithmically accelerated future, then we have to think about innovation as what is going to matter. And that gives us a very meaning-centric and therefore human-centric lens on innovation and technology and digital transformation and all of that. So we have what matters and what's going to matter. And I find that those two questions in tandem, sort of side by side, are a very clarifying exercise for leaders to be able to cut away, you know, a lot of the kind of extraneous ego or worry or confusion or whatever, and really get down to what is it that you say you're there to do or your organization exists to do? What is it? How is it that you would like that organization to meet the world? And how would you like to leave the world? You know, kind of that sort of lens and that sort of clarity, I think, really helps with the decision making.
And what are you seeing as some of the biggest issues that companies are facing?
I think some of the biggest issues companies are facing do relate to AI and how acceleration is changing consumer expectations and the marketplace. A lot of what I hear from clients is, you know, what if I do embrace automation right now, intelligent automation, and we start moving toward a solution that we can identify today. And then we know how fast this is all changing. What about 2 months from now, 6 months from now? And maybe this is an outdated solution. And I always feel like, you know, you're not worse off 2 or 6 months from now if you've pursued that solution than you were without pursuing it. Even if it does turn out that the solution you've chosen, you know, is maybe replaced by a newer direction, more than likely you're in a better situation. You've done a better job of preparing for what it's going to take to adapt to that future, to that, you know, reality or that change, the modality or technology. Because what comes with it, what comes with every digital transformation, every innovation, is a whole lot of cultural and behavioral modification that we don't usually talk a lot about. But that discussion is one of the most important. And as you say, you all are very versed in this, in change management and understanding how people get on board. So does that resonate with you?
Oh, of course, absolutely.
I saw you smiling over there.
This is obviously the world we live in, and we're seeing it not only with AI, but like climate change, for example. Mm-hmm. When you think about how many leaders now are actually making commitments that for which they don't know how they're going to achieve them.
Yeah.
And it takes the whole organization to get there and really get everybody behind it. When you talk about a purpose, saving the planet, that's a big one.
It sure is. Yeah. There's nothing, really nothing more urgent or important in that global scale than the climate crisis and what we do to deal with it. I think what I'm seeing from a business and leadership standpoint, though, is that there's a lot of reluctance to frame that conversation, and there's more readiness to talk about, oh wait, AI is changing everything, so let's talk about that. Well, you know, climate is changing everything too. We definitely need to be thinking about these things in an integrative way. You know, going back to what you asked earlier about, you know, these human superpowers, I do think of, I use the sort of shorthand both and. But oftentimes it's more than two things that you're integrating. It's not just both and, it's all of the above, or it's a version of what kinds of partial answers to questions we need to be looking for some integration to.
I thought it was really interesting to hear you speak about the in-between spaces between the questions and the answers. I love that. Can you just share with our listeners what you mean by that?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite things. We came across this model a few years ago and have been cultivating it and working on it with our clients ever since. There is a way to arrive at better decision making in the light of so much change and so much upheaval. And that is to recognize that we don't usually learn, we think we learn by asking questions and getting answers, but that isn't really true. We usually learn by asking questions and getting a lot of partial answers, and those partial answers are often in tension with one another. And so what we have to do, what we have to challenge ourselves to do, is look at those partial answers in the aggregate and look for, what are the tensions between those partial answers? What does it tell us that they may not perfectly align? Or if they do align, there's often something, you know, useful to know about that. Where's the commonality? But I think most leaders have had the experience of asking a question of their team and getting, you know, six different answers or eight different answers or whatever. And it's not that people are wrong. It's just that they're looking at, you know, different parts of the elephant, so to speak. So the leader's job is really to find the insight, the nugget of truth that's at the core of the tension between those answers. And then insights are this magical, almost like crystal, that can shine a light in whatever direction that you need it to. And so once you look at that insight through the context of the trends and externalities that you've been tracking, what you know about how the market is changing, for example, or what you know about regulations that are changing, once you shine that insight through that, it starts to give you the answer that you need for today, the timely approach that you need to take forward. What is the solution you're going to implement as of today? But what it also gives you, and this is the magical part, is usually some indication of what's going to matter. And I call that a bankable foresight. So it's something you don't need to implement today, but it is something that gives you a hint of what's going to matter tomorrow. And that means that you can begin to triangulate your decision-making from what your resources are now to what you need to, you know, you need to do today, to what you believe is going to be important and you're going to need to do tomorrow or in the future, whenever that is. And that is an incredibly helpful thing for leaders to not feel like they're making decisions in a vacuum, but they actually have some sense of continuity and a trajectory, a through line to those decision making, to those decisions, so that they are not feeling like every decision is just a, you know, a shot in the dark, and they, you know, maybe they get it right and maybe they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. That insights model and foresights, the foresights that come from it, I find are incredibly reassuring and incredibly powerful.
You know, it makes me kind of wonder too, because as we think about intuition, that's really how intuition's created, through various disparate things that get woven together over time, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And we call it intuition. But I think there's also, in my line of work, how I've built my work is around this notion of insights. This company is called KO yeah. Insights, because I think that insights are an incredibly important sort of disciplined approach to intuition, right? If you say, I have an intuition about something, then what an insight challenges you to do is, or an insight model challenges you to do is a little bit break down why. Where is that intuition coming from? What are the sort of qualitative data sources that are giving you the sense that that might be true? And that's all, that all comes back to, you know, when I say the word sense, sense making is an incredibly important part of meaning making. And so this all relates, it's all part of where we are in our heads as we're processing the world, and how we make sense of the world is how we make meaning in the world. And as we apply that to business, that is about purpose and about, you know, sort of scaffolding down purpose into our priorities and into our decision making, how we think about culture, how we think about a brand, how we think about experience making. And then and only then, by the way, do we start to think about data modeling around, you know, metrics that are meaningful and how we're going to bring data back into our decision making. And then and only then do we start applying technology to begin to amplify what we think we can be doing that's meaningful. But it's got to be, I think, a very disciplined process getting to that place where we're using data and technology in a way that supports and amplifies what is meaningful in the business before we start with data and technology. So many people think digital transformation is about technology, or that it should start with technology, but it's actually the last step, in a sense, in the planning that leads to it.
Well, you know, one of the things that brings to mind for me is a very popular subject right now about return to office and hybrid work. And, you know, so many clients of ours are really struggling with how do they really balance the two? And it seems to me that so much of it is about how do you create a digital experience that can equal or perhaps be even better than a personal experience. And what are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is, yeah, as you say, I think that we are in a new place as far as the digital, the virtual workplace and workforce is concerned. We definitely need to invest there and really learn some new skills as managers and leaders, understand how to cultivate, you know, remote sense of cohesion and culture and really double down on that. At the same time, where it is important to bring people back together, I think one of the things that leaders are often not doing as well is communicating with their teams about why, what the benefits are of bringing people back together, and why people should feel excited about the opportunity to come back and sort of reconnect with their colleagues and be, you know, physically proximate while they're working on projects together, and all of the nuanced ways that we benefit from being in person with one another. I think everyone kind of understands that at an intuitive level, but it really helps if managers are really explicit about what they see as the benefit and how people are going to thrive in those environments.
One of the things I've seen is that many, not all managers, are getting better at really letting go of control and recognizing that there are many ways to work. But one of the challenges that they continue to have is when we're not together, what are we losing? You know, they're worried about losing their culture, losing innovation, et cetera. And we counsel on this and write on this a lot, but I'd just love to get your thoughts because we're all figuring this out as we go, right? As a real tech expert, what are some of the things you're seeing that people are doing to use technology to connect each other?
I see some things that people are doing that are seem to me a little misguided. Like, I think when we were all in the office more often, there was this tendency toward forced fun or forced frivolity, right? That was a thing that that oftentimes people would complain about, that managers wanted to create culture by, you know, making people be there for happy hours on Fridays or something. And that doesn't always go over so well. And trying to recreate that, you know, over virtual environments doesn't always work well either. I think what we need to step back and realize is that what culture is a factor of is often shared experience and shared goals. So it really comes back again to this discussion of really setting the agenda with clarity and making people understand what the purpose is. How much are we moving the needle on any of the things that we say we need to be doing? If that's you know, completeness of metadata on files or records, then we can track that. And we know that, you know, when you're logged in and when you're being productive, you're going to be moving the needle on that. We don't necessarily need to track that on a minute by minute or hour by hour basis. So that's the kind of thing that I think people get caught up in, proxies that are easy to measure as opposed to proxies that are meaningful to measure.
I'd like to take us back to bankable foresights, because I would imagine everyone listening to the podcast now is really curious to hear, what are your bankable foresights?
I think that bankable foresights really are, I'm very proud of that coinage and what it implies and what a gift it is for leaders. But what I do see, you know, in the work I do with clients, oftentimes the work is looking at a product set that clients have and then trying to help them understand sort of the trend landscape and how they, what they're going to do to make sure it's future ready. By the way, this is one of my bugbears is that I cannot stand the term future proof. I don't know how that term ever got to be dominant in our discourse, but you cannot be future proof. There's no future proofing. The future is coming, like it or not. You can only be more or less future ready. So the job of bankable foresights is to make you more future ready. And some of the things that I see are that, you know, clearly we have got some major issues to address with climate change, as we've already discussed. We have, you know, that huge looming issue on the horizon. I think there's an incredible opportunity to use emerging technology and evolving technology to address some of these issues. I had the incredible opportunity in 2019 to moderate a panel at the COP25 Climate Change Summit, the UN COP25 in Madrid, and with a number of incredible world tech leaders, and talk about how we can use AI to fight climate change. So this is not new discourse. This is not a new conversation. You know, those of us who have been curious around this space have been talking about it for years, but I think the opportunity becomes more and more urgent and more opportune, in a sense, like it becomes richer the farther we get into witnessing how LLMs, you know, like ChatGPT and so on, how they get more and more sophisticated all the time. So there's an incredible opportunity there. I do think that we are at a place where we need to understand what AI is and does for us in a way that leads us better to the decision-making we need to do around it. We can't simply have a dichotomous discourse of, you know, either we're doomed or we're accelerating with no brakes. Like, seems like there's got to be a really healthy range of middle ground options that are sane and sensible and that are moderated to, you know, human values and to natural outcomes and, you know, an ecosystem approach to the whole thing. Those are some of the things that I think at a high level, very high level, they're not exactly bankable foresights, but they are that sort of overarching guidance of whatever decisions we make need to align with those. They need to be in concordance with what we see as the biggest priorities of our time. Leaders are challenged to lead in a time that is incredibly disruptive, has a lot of sort of new energies and new emerging ideologies and discourse and division of discourse. But I think we just need to rise to the moment. We have a lot of tools and some great opportunities to do that well.
One of the things we talked about is being really clear about what we want and what we want at scale. So let's talk a little bit about scale and how to scale. You know, we're real believers in democratizing the agency of our people and really letting go, right? So that everybody can get involved. How do you see businesses do that?
Yeah, I think there's a different approach for different types of businesses. Clearly, you know, the closer you are to something like, you know, manufacturing or supply chain or construction or, you know, something like that, it's a little bit harder to build community or a movement around some of the ideas therein. But I think the more you're on the consumer facing side, or the more that your work dovetails with people and how people exist and live in the world, or that they can sort of sense their human experience around, the more you have an opportunity, I think, to get people involved in envisioning what the future should look like for that human experience. I think about, like, you know, IKEA is one example that comes to mind of, I wrote about this in A Future So Bright, that they did some experimentation with encouraging the use of reusable bags before it really became a big trend. And the thought that, you know, if you're really trying to create impact at scale when we think about climate and what it looks like to not have plastic bags or single-use plastic. What does it look like to then, you know, build all these kind of opportunities for people to adopt reusable bags that are like craveable, that, you know, that you pay 99 cents for, and then are you going to use it everywhere? They're figuring out nudges. They're figuring out how to build movements into the way people actually go about their lives. And that even if IKEA isn't an aspirational brand, it is a stylish brand. It is one that people can feel like, okay, this is an accessory that I can use in my life. So I think there are ways to think about how an alignment between a business objective or the purpose of a business meets the purposes that people are trying to achieve when they interact with your business. And looking for that alignment, looking for how to scale that alignment, as opposed to looking for just how to scale your business, is really where it's key. I think really trying to think about what is that experience dimensionally? How can we think about building out something that tech data and technology and all of the tools of brand and culture and values and experience all can amplify that alignment where we meet the people that we meet. And that's I think, the most powerful opportunity for scale and really dimensionalizing the values that we would like to have in common with our people.
Let's also explore scaling optimism, because we know that in a lot of organizations, people are burnout. There's a lot of fatigue, a lot of change fatigue, but just fatigue with the world in general. How do you yourself, first of all, maintain your own optimism and resilience?
You know, I think I look to some of the wisdom that I've learned over the years from various sources, but one of them is my absolute favorite source of wise writing is Rebecca Solnit. I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with her work. If you're not, do yourself a favor and pick up some of her books, some of her essays. Just a brilliant writer. And she has a book called Hope in the Dark. And that book talks about the opportunity for communities to rise from situations like Katrina, you know, New Orleans and Katrina, and how communities can form around hope, around, you know, the resilience and rebuilding. And there's an incredible human condition at work there that we, in our worst moments, when things are hardest for us, is when we often find the deepest reserves of who we are. And so I think it's an incredible opportunity for us to look at the tough times that we face collectively and think, maybe this is when we really figure out how we get to the bottom of who we are as a people, as a species. And what do we need to do to create the conditions for that to be true? What do we need to do to bring that out in us and ourselves, in our neighbors, in the people that we interact with, and how do we foster that hope? How do we bring that to be? So that's the opportunity, I think, that we have individually, all of us, and leaders especially, thinking about how to bring that sense of hope and agency and power to the people that they employ, to the people that they serve through, you know, sort of customer communities and to the world in general.
What are you seeing now in terms of some of the biggest opportunities that we have to do something now? Like if you, when you talk to these leaders, what are you hoping will change as you leave?
What I think is the biggest opportunity actually doesn't happen at the UN or World Government Summit level. There's a lot of great, important discourse that happens there. But I think what is actually more encouraging, perhaps for, you know, your listeners and the folks who are part of this discussion, is that most of the change I believe that we can affect in our generation, in our time, happens at the business leadership level. I think there's an incredible opportunity for all business leaders to look at, say, the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 goals that have been articulated. They were articulated in 2015, and they're a set of goals that we're supposed to be meaningfully accomplishing or at least making progress on by 2030. And then, of course, I'm sure we'll be setting a new set of goals, you know, leading us into the next decades ahead. But those 17 goals include things like quality education and no poverty and some really wonderful, ambitious goals. They do not exist outside of a business framework. They are not meant for charity only or for for governments to do alone. They're meant to be things that as a whole, as a planet, we are all contributing to. And there are ways in which every business I've ever consulted with or spoken to has had some relevance to at least one of those goals on a for-profit level, even. You know, that's, I think, the most incredibly encouraging part of all this is that you really don't need to be re-engineering your entire business to be making a difference. You just need to be thinking about how can I now look at supply chain considerations? How can I think about the ways we're nudging consumers to make different choices? How can we think about, you know, the ways that we're spending in a carbon footprint sense? How can we think about any of those considerations? There are so many of them. Or how can we work toward improving the education pipeline leading into the products that we build or that sort of thing? Think about like Duolingo, for example. You know, they're a for-profit company. They're a very gamified app. But they're, of course, it's language learning, but they're also thinking about how are we going to improve the algorithms that help people learn. And so it's a way of thinking about education at a global level across all kinds of human-centric outcomes and initiatives. So I think that's something that it's not too ambitious, and it's something that every company can be thinking about in alignment with the growth and the work that they're doing. And you'll hear again and again in my answers, it really gets back to this sense of purpose, really being clear about what it is we're trying to do, what it is we're trying to do at scale. Those are challenging questions, and they're questions that in many ways leaders haven't often asked in those terms, not in the sense of getting it down to a crisp, distinct, you know, sort of 3 to 5 word articulation, as opposed to, you know, a fuzzy-wuzzy mission statement that doesn't really make a lot of sense to people.
Yeah, well, we're certainly kindred spirits in that regard. We talked a lot about a variety of things that leaders can do, but as you know, the subject of this podcast is Let Go and Lead. And I'm curious to just ask, what do you see that leaders really need to let go of?
Yeah, it's such a really provocative framework for the discussion. I think there's a couple of fears that I think leaders could stand to let go of, like fear of change, fear of failure, or, you know, I think iteration through failure often leads to success. So that's an incredible opportunity. Maybe some beliefs that leaders should be able to let go of, like one of the things that comes out of long years in my career, that a belief that their instinct is always better than data. Conversely, that a belief that data is always better than instinct. So, you know, I think a healthy approach really does understand how to integrate those and make the most sense, make the most meaning out of whether you're looking at data or instinct. And then, you know, we talked about this insights model and the bankable foresights. And I think for me, the thing that's worth letting go is the idea that a question is always in search of an immediate and immediately satisfying answer, as opposed to that it's the pathway toward exploration into what will ultimately provide the most clarifying and timeless insight that will then lead to timely outcomes and bankable foresights, things that can actually help you make decisions for today and for the future with greater clarity overall. I think there's a lot of wisdom, received wisdom through generations, that suggests that we really ought to be spending more time on learning, on getting clearer on what we're trying to get to the bottom of, and really making sense of how we set up the question or how we set up the context of what it is we're trying to solve for before we try to solve it.
Well, Kate, this was so much fun, and I really enjoyed your insights. And thank you so much for being on Let Go and Lead.
Thank you, Meryl. Thank you for having me. What a great format you have. I really appreciate it. And good luck to everyone.
Thanks. This was a fun, thought-provoking chat. I enjoyed every minute with Kate. Several things in our conversation resonated deeply with me. I loved her idea that to improve decision-making, we must pay attention to the in-between spaces, the spaces between the questions and the answers. She shared that there are seldom great answers to the questions we asked. In fact, there are often partial answers, and those are often in tension with one another. As leaders, our job is to sift through those partial answers in the aggregate to find the insights and weave together a new answer. I saw this as a fascinating build on leadership intuition. Kate's deep passion for purpose struck a real chord too. She talked about how our tendency toward meaning makes us uniquely human, not like other animals and not like machines. She describes purpose as the shape that meaning takes in business. Once a leader's clear about purpose, they can cut away the noise and focus on what matters. Purpose is where leaders create a compelling view of the future, a view that becomes a galvanizing force internally and can have monumental impact on employees' motivations as well as their well-being. As we see increasing levels of employee fatigue and burnout, the opportunity to create genuinely purposeful organizations is one I'd love to see more leaders commit to. Lastly, I loved Kate's infectious energy and her term strategic optimism. Kate describes it as an ability to apply rationality and sensibility to optimism. She says that you're in control of a lot more than you believe yourself to be. The future is only a continuation of the past and the present, and in the present, you can still make decisions to shape the future. That optimism is so amazing and such a key leadership ingredient. And since the title of this podcast is Let Go and Lead, I asked her what leaders should let go of to be better. Kate said leaders need to let go of their belief that instinct is always better than data, and conversely, a belief that data is always better than instinct. A healthy approach understands how to integrate both concepts. Well said from the tech humanist. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Kate. Remember to subscribe to Let Go and Lead on your favorite podcast platform and be the first to hear conversations and ideas from other thought-provoking champions, including Mark Miller, Julie Hobsbawm, and Bonnie St. John. And don't forget to check out archive interviews with Amy Edmondson, Marshall Goldsmith, Seth Godin, and others. Thanks for joining, and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.